So welcome to This Cycling Life Leadership Bites. Today, I will be joined by Bernard Moedermann to interview Bill Gordon. A Masters World Champion on the track, Bill also has a bunch of Australian National Championships titles to his name. In addition to his achievements on the bike, Bill has also had an incredibly successful business career. He was founder of one of Australia's largest bicycle retailers, Bikeforce. And more recently, Bill and his son have taken on a master franchise for the fitness brand Cycle Bar, an indoor cycling boutique. And they have plans to expand across the country. So, Bill, great to have you on on the show. Can you maybe give us a quick update on Cycle Bar? It seems like a very exciting concept.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, firstly. Cycle Bar is, as you say, an indoor cycling studio. Spin cycling, for want of a better word. It's not like the old spin. But we've now got seven studios sold across the country, two in Perth, three in Sydney, one in Melbourne, one in Brisbane. So they'll all start being developed and opened mid-year or between May and June. So it's been, you know, we looked at trying, you know, hoping to maybe three or four studios by mid-year, but it's been accepted so well, and the interest in it's been amazing. So we're super excited about it.
Yeah, and I mean here in Europe, Bill, I mean we've seen a massive uptick in virtual cycling, indoor cycling, related to, of course, you know, the whole COVID-19, the pandemic. Sure. How has sort of the whole, you know, cycle bar sort of indoor cycling phenomenon been evolving in Australia over the last couple of years?
It's probably been stagnant in Australia. Mm-hmm. Like I look at it, and you know, when we first did some research on it, it was like you had your gyms at the top level, underneath that you had Pilates, underneath that you had yoga, and then a number of other things, and then cycling or spin cycling was pretty much at the bottom of that list. 20 years ago it was popular to a degree. Mm-hmm. And that was the attraction, is that we believed that we could bring this model in, and you know, we're a concierge service, you know, it's concert sound, it's change of lighting, you know, it's very different to what the old spin was. It's a very, you know, it's a great environment to be in. Mm. And so, you know, we were hoping to have 300 members in our first studio within the first month of opening. We had 300 before we opened.
Wow.
And we're currently at 470 riders. Mm. So the uptake has been amazing. And, you know, we spend a fair amount of, you know, time marketing the business. Obviously, that's just an ongoing thing. You can't market it and then leave it and hope that it's going to continue. So we've got a plan and a structure about how we do all that. And that's been the secret. And then making sure that when people come to the studio, that you're providing that experience that we're talking about in all our marketing.
Yep. Well, I guess experience is very important, you know, because I think, you know, when people think Australia, they think sunshine and beaches and open roads, you know, that you should be cycling outside. So, I mean, what's the most attractive thing about a concept like Cycle Bar for that sort of core audience you're serving?
Yeah, I think the perception that we are chasing the cafe rider or the racing cyclist is wrong, because from the moment we started, our market was 25 to 55 year old female. That was our predominant market. Mm. And out of our 470 members is probably 400 females. But that said, what's happened is we've had a few guys go in there, and then we're now getting classes. We have classes of roughly 44 people when they're full. And we're getting a dozen guys come in. So it's all been word of mouth. So they're all starting, whether they be triathletes or guys that do a bit of racing, are all starting to slowly move in, because it's in the racing scene, it's sort of seen as a bit girly, for want of a better description. Mm-hmm. But I can guarantee you, you know, the guys that I've, friends of mine that I've persuaded to come in and have a go, have walked out absolutely legless.
I don't know, Bill. It sounds pretty good to me, man. Who needs Tinder when you've got 400 ladies signed up and 12 guys? I think that sounds like
exactly.
a pretty a pretty compelling proposition for a lot of people. But look, I mean, it's great to have the update on CycleBar. We'll provide a little bit of information as well, you know, in the credits for the video. But why don't we talk about your life? I know Bernard's got a lot of questions because, of course, besides being an entrepreneur and a business person, you've also been riding your bike for a very long time. Bernard?
Yeah, Bill. It's a great story you're telling so far, but what interests me is how did it all start as a youth? What attracted you in sports and even more so in cycling?
I got brought up in a small country town called Esperance, which is 750 kilometres from Perth. So it's a little oasis, a long way from anywhere. And I played football, I played basketball, cricket. I did all the sports, all these team sports. And I loved football and I loved them all. But I felt like, you know, I wasn't achieving what I wanted to achieve because even if I played well, we could still lose. So that was my mentality about it. And then a friend, you know, bought a racing bike. There was a club just starting to form. My dad wouldn't buy me one initially, but he got embarrassed into it by a friend of a friend, his father. And my first bike was $20 bike, a fixed wheel bike. And we used to have, my first race was in a straight line on a public road. And it was like a track handicap race. And so they marked it all out. And, you know, that was my first race. So from a little country town, and the bug just got me from day one. I was reasonably, you know, I finished second in my first race. And I was one of the stronger riders for whatever reason. And, you know, I used to go out at lunchtimes and during when I was an apprentice cabinet maker and go out and ride for 45 minutes of my lunch hour so that I could try and be better than the next person, try and bridge that gap to the better riders in the club. So that's where I started.
It's funny what you're saying there, Bill, because I, you know, when I came to Europe and I explained what it was like racing as a youth in Australia, you know, this whole concept of handicap racing was very foreign to the Europeans because I think it originated from England actually. But in Australia, it was kind of like athletic racing on a bike. So when you were doing a road race, you know, you were handicapped. So you would have some guys heading off with a 5-minute advantage, and then you'd have the 4-minute group and the 3-minute group, and then the scratchman. You know, we always aspired to be part of the scratchman group. It did, of course, develop a very special kind of racing because it was full gas, you know, from the start and developing that real, guts and grit, because when you're in any one of those groups, there was no loafing, right? It's not like sitting in a peloton and sitting on the back cruising for the ride.
Yeah.
Very interesting. But how was it riding around the air of Esperance? Because, Bill, I grew up in Shepparton, you know, in Victoria, in the southeast of Australia. And my ride was basically a 70-kilometre ride where I would do 20 kilometres in a straight line, turn left for another 20 kilometres, turn left for another 20 kilometres, and there was nothing but flat farm fields and the occasional orchard. How was it for you riding around the Esperance region?
Esperance was, I generally trained after work, so it was dark. And the lights we had then, I can't believe that I went into some of the places I went with the basically a little candle on the front light, you know, in the rear light. Just
the dynamo.
I just can't believe I survived. You know, in the middle of nowhere, pitch black, you couldn't see 20 feet in front of you. But yeah, we had, you know, flat roads. We had a couple of hills. We had a beach, a ride, which started basically in the town. And then if you went along the coast, it was quite hilly. So you had to ride up what they call Wireless Hill to get to it. And then along the coast. So we had some good terrain. And, we ended up, after I won my first race, after about 5 or 6 weeks, it was a handicap race. You know, my dad all of a sudden become interested. You know, he ended up being club president. They built a cycling track down there. So, you know, it became huge.
Yeah, it's amazing how that grassroots movements in many of these small towns across Australia happened. And again, you know, where I grew up in Shepparton, we had an Olympic standard outdoor velodrome in a town of, at that time, 12,000 people. And there was this sort of grassroots, you know, passion for it. When did you start to realize that you really did have some talent, not just in terms of the local cycling, but of course you did go on to state and national level? How did that evolve? And then what were some of your fond memories of that racing more at the higher elite and national level?
Sure. My dad used to drive me up on a weekend during the winter. you know, we're talking 7.5-8 hour drive. He'd drive me up on Friday night. I'd race Sunday, Saturday, and we'd drive back on Sunday. So he'd drive me up probably 4 or 5 times, you know, in a winter season. And I did okay. I certainly wasn't winning, but I did okay enough to know that actually I'm competitive here. And then eventually I decided that, you know, Perth had to be the place to be. I moved to Perth for that reason, to ride my bike. And I was only 15, I think, because I left school when I was 14, so I left very young. But at 15, I was a cabinet maker, apprentice cabinet maker, and I decided Perth was a place to be. I worked really just to make ends meet. You know, my whole life, even at that stage, was about riding my bike, because it gave me something, you know, I could really, you know, strive for, and I was reasonably successful. I suppose the time that I really noticed is, you know, I was up in Perth by myself, basically, you know, sharing a place with some older guys, and I had to ride out to 20 kilometers to this bike shop to get my bike fixed on this Saturday morning. And then I had to ride there from there 30 kilometers out to a state championship time trial, right? And it was over 20 kilometers, I mean, you know, under 18 one. And I got second. So that was the first time I thought, oh, okay. And they ended up rerunning it for some reason 2 weeks later, and I got a lift out there and I won. Mm. So that was the point where I thought, oh, hang on, I've actually, you know, got some, I can probably do this reasonably well if I commit to it.
So, and what, were there any dreams sparkling then from going pro or coming to Europe?
Not that early, probably a year or so after that. Yeah, once I turned 18, I suppose, I then turned pro straight away, because I was the number one amateur in WA at that stage, and I was only 17 or 18. And so I turned pro, and that was a much stronger competition. You know, guys were a bit older. I think I went from being number one to about number 30 and hanging on for grim death. And that took me to another level. And so that following year, when I was 19, I won the Australian Championship, my first Australian Championship on the road, which was 100 kilometres. It's under 23 championship now. So that, and then the next day I rode a criterium race, which was an all-in criterium race with all the senior guys and that, and I finished second, which to this day I believe I could have won, but, you know, I couldn't get out to unleash. So that was the turning point. That was the point where I thought, no, I can be okay at this.
Yeah. And you did continue, I mean, as racing as a domestic pro for some years, but then you decided ultimately not to go on and pursue perhaps a step into Europe. What drove that decision to actually step away from your path that you'd been on as a domestic pro?
It was more about financial decision more than anything else. My family had no money. You know, I was living from week to week. You know, I was winning some money, and which was probably the bonuses that I was getting, but, you know, we just didn't have the cash. And to go to Europe, you know, I probably could have scraped enough to get to an airfare, but I had no contacts. It was just the one thing in my life where I've gone left instead of right. You know, normally I would take that risk. I'm a risk taker. And it was the one time that I look back on that I didn't take the risk, and I don't regret it. I do look back and go, you know, like, look at some of the old pros, you know, the Alan Pipers and the Phil Andersons who I raced with here, and look back and sort of semi-regret it, but I got so much out of my business life, and then I was fortunate enough over a period of time to come back to cycling and be successful. Sort of felt, I think it filled that void that I was, that I had for a long time because I didn't go to Europe. And, you know, I also saw a lot of guys go to Europe and come back with a tail between their legs, never really raced here again. They just got belted. And, you know, so from that point of view, I looked at it and thought, well, yeah, maybe my decision was correct.
Yeah, that makes complete sense, Bill. I mean, of course, the era that you were talking about, I mean, there was no such thing at that time as the Australian Institute of Sport. There was no real structured path for young guys like yourself to make that journey into Europe. And you mentioned guys like Alan Piper. And of course, if you've read his book, you'll be absolutely astounded by the struggles and the adversity that he had to overcome just to race his bike at that time. Bernard, I know you've got some questions about what happened next with Bill. So why don't we move into that phase of Bill's life?
Yeah, well, it's interesting to see how humble you are about like how you did on the local scene, but you're talking about world, you were competing with world famous guys. So then now having your business, would you tell us what exactly of your, let's say, early cycling career are you taking with you in your entrepreneurship today? What are the main strengths that you recognize and take with you?
Probably the fact I never gave up. You know, it sounds really basic, but it's really that simple. That, you know, I went through some good times, early days, and then some really dark times, you know, in business for a couple of years, and came out at the end of that much wiser and much stronger. And I think the fact that I was prepared to learn and listen made a huge difference. So, in learning from mistakes, and you know, it was no different from cycling. My very first coach always told me that, you know, you should learn more from your losses than your wins, because you want to know, and you also want to learn how you won, why did you win? But you know, your losses are so important that you don't get all grumpy about it. You know, more or less, you look into it and go, well, you know, what could I have done better, or could I have prepared better, or did I just make mistakes on the day? And those things are the things that I took into business, that I was prepared to learn. I was prepared to just keep getting up. You know, every time I got knocked down, I'd get back up. And, you know, we turned it into a very, very good business. But, you know, being willing to do whatever you need to do to get the result. And, you know, in business, that may be as simple as picking up the broom. You know, it's not that complicated. It's just about being focused on where you want to go, and having a picture of or a dream that you know what you think this can do, you know, and making sure that you just focus on that.
I mean, Bill, you're talking there about, I mean, setting goals for yourself, which of course, as an athlete, you do constantly.
Sure.
And so can you talk about that in terms of, were there differences between, you know, what you saw in setting goals for yourself on the bike versus setting goals in business? Because one of the things you said very early on was that one of the things you loved about cycling was that it was very individual, that it was about me and my performance. But business is quite different to that, isn't it? Because you can set a goal, but it's not just you going to that goal. It's also how you bring other people along. Can you talk to us about that aspect?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the things I probably struggled with early days, because I was brought up in a pretty average upbringing, for want of a better word. It was quite a violent upbringing. And so cycling gave me that out. It gave me that out to do my own thing and to control what I was doing. And, you know, I was probably quite an angry person for a long time. I wasn't violent or anything like that, but didn't take me much to get angry about something. And once I learned to control that, I was a much better person, a much better cyclist, and a much better business person. And it's funny, again, another coach of mine early days, he said, Bill, if we can ever channel that anger you have, you'll be world champion. And he took me, I don't know, 50 years to, or 30 years to learn to channel it. But yeah, no, the thing was, once I learned that, and once I learned to admit and be able to talk about my upbringing and stuff like that, it made me a totally different person, totally different person. And one of the things we do now, and you know, we focused on with Cycle Bar, is to ensure that we bring in good people along. And we want the best people in our business. And, you know, I want people in the business that are smarter than me, to, you know, so that I can lean on them, they can lean on me, and I certainly have the experience, but they're going to have all the know-how and the smarts of what you need to do in business these days. So.
Yeah, that resonates totally to me. But when you look at what you're doing today, you're running your business, obviously, and you're still a very active cyclist. What would be advice for people that are kind of like struggling with the juggle of doing their hobby, their work, their family? How would you go? What would be your main advice there?
Being organized, I think, is the thing. Like, I rode, even when I made my comeback, I was still working full time, and I'm still working full time right now. But I always, worked that I could train in the mornings, and I was home by 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. So I could, my family were a bit older, so I didn't have to worry too much about that. But if your family's younger, then you're still home for breakfast and in time to go to work. So I encourage, people to plan their day. Make sure you have to give time to yourself. You have to, whether that be going for a walk, riding a bike or whatever. But as a business person, you can't just sit there and be 120% focused on that. You have to have a little bit of time for yourself to have that balance, and also allow time for your family, because something will give, and it will either be your family life will give or your business life will suffer. So finding balance is the thing, and focus on what that balance is, whilst trying to ride, if you can ride early in the morning. Like, I go out at 5 o'clock now in the morning, and I can do everything I need to do and not miss a moment of work if I need to.
It's interesting what you say there, Bill, because I mean, that's certainly what a lot of the people who watch This Cycling Life are grappling with, juggling those three balls of their their career, their family and relationships, and of course then their passion for their bike. But I guess, one of the aspects of that is also about life stages, right? Because I mean, you became an entrepreneur in your 20s. You became a dad, and then sometimes, we see people who are, say, in their mid-30s, and they're actually trying to do it all. They're trying to be super successful in their career, be a great parent, and be an elite masters athlete. For me, that's a very, very difficult kind of equation to add up. What's your view on that in terms of how we look at our life as an athlete, as an entrepreneur, as a parent, in terms of these stages that we go through?
I'd always put family first, regardless of anything. That's something that I've, just developed myself, that I would always, and I suppose that's a reflection of my upbringing, that I didn't have that. So I would always put family first. That's the number one priority. But if you can find I would suggest finding a coach that understands, if from a cycling perspective, finding a coach that understands the time you've got available, and you can do very, very well based on limited time. I think we all know that, these days in particular with the different ways of training and stuff. So that's, if you really want to focus, really want to go well in your cycling. But, the other thing is to be realistic and go, well, in this period of time, my focus is my family, and obviously I need to work. So maybe I can ride B grade instead of A grade. It's about taking that ego away for a little while and resting it on the side and looking at what's important to you. That's what I would look at. And I still raced right through till I was probably late 20s, and I had a young family and things like that. And it was a juggle, but, we managed to do it. But I always, that was always family first. But you had to be well organized. be well organized.
And when you say well organized, it sounds obvious for me, for you. But can you explain that a little better? Because it's a big word, being organized. But what do you understand exactly with that?
Well, I think from a business point of view, and it's really difficult if you work for yourself, but if you don't work for yourself, it's a bit easier, where you can segregate your time at work. So your time at work is your time at work. And then trying to, as I said, if you're getting up early to ride, and then allocating time for family before work and after work. Before work, obviously, it wouldn't be a long period, and it wouldn't be normally anyway for the average person. But allocating time after work, for you know, reading books to your kids to, when they go to bed and things. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to spend 3 hours with them, but you've got to spend time with them every day possible. And so, you know, it's about organizing, you know, your training in the morning, if that's when you can train, you know, time early before work, you know, to at least see your kids off to school, or at least see them if you can before they go to school. Again, it doesn't have to be long. They don't have to rely on you for that. But then spending time with them, you know, doing your work, you know, whether that's 8 or 10 hours a day, depending on your workload, trying to leave that at work, and then spending time with your family and your children after. You know, working for yourself, it's can be a little bit difficult because you do take your work home. you know, but again, you've got to, you know, I don't know whether I was that good at it, but, you know, you've got to try and put it aside and not, and make sure you're giving that time to, you know, to the other people in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense, Bill. The thing I'm really curious to hear about is like when did that fire start for you again? You know, like that real desire to say, you know what, I'm going to come back. And you have come back. I mean, when we look at what you've done in the last 10 years in terms of national world championships, can you just talk to us about that journey and how it felt early on? Because you were away from competition for a very long time.
Yeah, I was away for 20 plus years. So we moved to Melbourne. We moved the business. We decided we were going to relocate to Melbourne and relocate the business, the head office, to Melbourne instead of Perth. Based on that, we wanted to expand on the East Coast. And while you're in on the West Coast, you're not really taken serious as such in business life. So we felt we weren't anyway. So we decided to move the whole family over to Melbourne. It was going to be a 2-year journey. It ended up 10. I have to say I love my time in Melbourne. And so we moved the whole business over there. We sold a business here that we had, one of our stores we owned. We actually sold that off and then moved everything to Melbourne. Opened another retail, a very large retail store in Melbourne. And then, you know, I was just riding my bike for fun. You know, it was just riding my bike every now and then. And I heard about a group ride, which was in Melbourne, which left at 5:45 in the morning. So I went and joined that, and they would ride down to a place called Wardiellick and then down along Beach Road back to the city. And from Beach Road to the city was just full gas. You know, it was just full on. You know, and it was, you know, in the early days, I was probably 10 kilos overweight. And it was just over a period of time that probably about an 8-week period that I got stronger and stronger and stronger. And it was riding regularly and doing this ride 2 days a week, that eventually I become one of the strongest guys in that group. And they would swap off turns at the front for that last 20 kilometers. And sometimes it was only two of us doing it. And we're doing 50 plus Ks an hour. And so from that, a couple of guys came up to me and said, oh, you know, you should race. And they didn't know who I was, what I'd done. And I said, oh, look, I've done that. I've been there, done that. You know, and I just left it at that. And every day they would be on me, you've got to race, you've got to race. So I relented and ended up going to St. Kilda Cycling Club and rode Big Road and finished fifth. I mucked up completely and finished fifth. And then I went to, over next month, I won 8 Big Road races at all different clubs. And so I was banned from riding Big Road anywhere in Melbourne.
Right.
And then I was riding, as a 50-year-old, I was riding A grade in Melbourne. So that's sort of the story. I blame a couple of guys that, you know, basically I say I got in with the wrong crowd.
Yeah.
And here I am. Yeah.
Right. That's great to hear, Bill. And I mean, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about the differences, you know, because I certainly experienced that. You know, I raced as a young guy. Of course, mum and dad were there watching me, my friends. But I found it very different as an emotional experience, actually racing as a master. And, you know, that feeling of standing on the podium in your 50s compared to standing on a podium in your teens or 20s. Can you talk to us about how you've experienced that?
No different to when I was 20. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. You know, like getting up on the podium is what you're racing for, you know, and just that little bit of recognition, I suppose, goes with it. You're certainly not racing for the money or anything like that, but you're racing to, you know, I'm a super competitive person anyway, as most cyclists are, but, you know, just to be there and like, I got a big kick out of racing A grade being 50 years old and finishing in the top 10. To me, that was winning. That was like, you know, that was winning for me, you know, and people telling me I couldn't, you know, you'll never get back to being that strong as you were when you were 25 or 30. You know, your heart rate won't go up the same. And like my average heart rate for a time trial is the same as it was when I was 25. You know, so, and, you know, there's certain areas that you obviously lose. You lose that little bit of speed. That was the one thing I learned. You know, I certainly learned to hang in with the top guys. I was smart enough to do that. I was strong enough to be there, but I couldn't sprint with them. Yet I could sprint with anyone else. I could only just hang on in the sprint. And that's why I was being, you know, anywhere from 6th to 10th. So, yeah, you lose your top end speed. But when you go back to racing 50-year-olds, they've lost their top end speed too, so it doesn't make any difference. But you can, you know, the numbers that you put out are certainly, you're certainly capable of putting out very similar numbers. And you probably, I don't know whether you can hold that power longer or whatever, but yeah, I certainly, you know, I put it down to most guys when they're in their, you know, master's ages, they go for a ride. I never went for a ride. My riding was to ride in that group and go as hard as I possibly can until I dropped. And that was the difference between me racing A grade and those guys not even being able to ride B grade properly. So that was the difference. It's just knowing, just working so much harder rather than just riding along and doing 2 hours or 3 hours and coming back, you know, maybe a little bit tired, but no deep-seated fatigue.
Would you describe the mental difference, or no, the difference in enjoyment mentally about achieving something when you were 25 years old and now?
I think at 25, it was about driving myself, as I mentioned earlier, you know, just trying to achieve something that no one in my family, none of my cousins or anything like that had achieved. Nobody in my family achieved anything. And so that was, it was about achieving something for myself and probably to show them that I went out on my own and did okay. When I was 50, it was just about proving to myself that I could still do it. And that I started racing, the idea was that I wanted to be the best 50-year-old cyclist in the country. That was my plan. And I achieved that, and I achieved that sort of going through the different ages and stuff like that. So that was always been my goal, was to try and be the best, you know, in my age group, whether it be, you know, it started off at national level and then it drifted, you know, for 10 years I chased in, you know, the world, you know, Grand Fondo championships and stuff like that, and the time trials, and you know, I finished fourth in two of the time trials, but just couldn't get on the podium. And you know, and then it turned out a mate just, you know, wanting to, you know, go and ride the track national or track world championships in LA. And my son happened to live there at that time. It's the only reason I went. But we trained, you know, as I said, we trained super hard for it, but I didn't expect to go there and win 3 medals, let alone winning a championship. So, but, you know, it just goes to show you stay at something long enough.
That being the best at 50, isn't that translating in how you're running your business? Like being the best in the business as well too?
Yeah, it's the same principle. Like we want to be the best in this business, and we want to take, you know, indoor cycling up alongside, just under the gyms and alongside Pilates and yoga and all those things. And we're doing that. We're proving that. You know, even though it's a small sample at the moment, we're proving that with, you know, with the studio that we've got open. And so it's just, yeah, it's exactly the same thing. And, you know, it's funny, I had a word to one of our staff the other day and they'd done something not quite what we expect. And I, you know, my words were, that's not our gold standard. We need to make sure we maintain that gold standard. And that's all I had to say. I wasn't grumpy or growled at them. They just knew exactly what I meant. And so that's, you know, what we're striving to do.
Yeah.
Great.
Good, Bill. Can you maybe just talk, I'd just love to hear from you. How were the emotions in LA? I mean, when you actually did get up to step on that podium and you were wearing that world champion jersey that you probably dreamed about when you were 17 years old, 16 years old. I mean, how was that emotionally as an experience in your life?
I've stood at the World Grand Fondo Championships, Time Trial Championships, and seen people get up there, and I've gone, I want that. I want to hear the national anthem, and stand up there. So when I got up there in LA, I was dumbstruck. I was nearly in tears. If I hadn't been looking, and my son was there, his wife and my grandchildren there. And luckily, I couldn't look at them because I would have been up on the podium, with tears running down. But I've got a photo that you can see that I'm just holding it back as much as I possibly can. And, I unashamedly, proud of that fact, that I was so emotional about it. And then so excited, the emotion came in first and the excitement came later when I realized what I'd done. Great moment.
And did you get a chance to get back to St. Kilda with those guys wearing that jersey, Bill? Was that?
St. Kilda were amazing. They presented me with a club jersey with the world stripes on it at one of the criterions. So they were amazing. They really supported me and were very encouraging and all that sort of thing. They were fantastic. A fantastic club.
Great. But, Bernard, as I'm listening to Bill, I'm reflecting on the TED Talk that you gave recently, actually, which talked about the winner's mindset. And I think it might be interesting, I mean, because Bernard, you talk about self, and the mindset. Could you maybe just frame that for us? Because I think everything that Bill has talked to us about today covers everything that you spoke about in your talk.
Well, yes. Well, the Bill, the self stands for self-belief, enjoyment, leading language, and fortitude. So you're talking all the time about believing in yourself and that you wanted to prove that, and you did it. Then everything that you were doing had a certain joy, even in your business. And then what struck me the most was your leading language when you just said, like, this is not our golden standard, or you said it somewhere like that. Mm-hmm. And then the fortitude is, well, the proof of your entire career, starting as a young kid riding a bike. Your dad brought you 700 kilometers far away to do things. And now you build up a business like that. To me, this is really the proof of a winner's mindset of a person that found what he wanted to do. Does that resonate with you? Because
yeah, it does. Yeah.
You believe in yourself. Because you come from a background where there was not much. So it's not like daddy gave you a lot of money to spend. So you had to believe in yourself. Otherwise, it wouldn't have worked because you made big decisions, moving and all that stuff. Then, like the moment you talk about being on the podium in Vegas or in Los Angeles, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of enjoyment even further than that. And the lead the language we spoke about. And I think you need fortitude to do what you've done over so many years and build out what you have built. So do you agree that that is really like, it resonates when you have those things together, that things can work?
Yeah, it's certainly not one thing. It's a number of things, whether it be making, decisions, being prepared to make decisions, whether they tough or not, having courage to, to take on new challenges, all those sorts of things, and being resilient. We talk about cyclists being resilient, and there's no better word, I don't think, is being. We are resilient. We keep bouncing back. As I said, the focus, the whole thing. It's there's lots of pieces to the puzzle, and if you can put them all together, and learning, I think, listening and learning is probably the biggest thing I learned was, I love listening to people that, whether they're doing talks or successful people from all walks of life, you learn something from everybody if you're prepared to listen. There's a difference between hearing and listening.
Exactly.
You know, you can hear something, but whether you're listening or not, it's a different story. And, you know, like I've dabbled in lots of things and tried to help people along the way. And sometimes you just go, they're not listening.
Yeah, well, you're hearing,
right. But they're not listening.
Because when you really hear what you need to hear and you learn from it, then you get an ability that sometimes you can turn obstacles into opportunities, or at least into starting points. And that's what you did most probably and over your entire career. So yeah, that's great. Great.
So we're going to wrap it up very soon. But sure. An interesting thing, of course, is that, you know, when we achieve things in life, and certainly for you standing on that podium in LA, it's an incredible feeling. But then there's also the tendency for people to come to us and say, but what's next? I mean, to what extent is that important? You know, I mean, because sometimes we do become too goal oriented or too goal focused. Are there also times in your life where you're just happy to just cruise, just to do what you're doing and not be too focused or obsessed about that next goal? Is that maybe something you've had to learn along the way?
Yeah, it is. I've certainly had to learn that along the way. But I think winning in LA, initially it gave me, you know, obviously that, you know, that knowledge that I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. But it also came with a bit of a lead weight as well, because on myself, that I then had a standard to meet as a cyclist racing. And I probably raced the full Criterion season with that lead weight. And I did okay, but I can't say it was the most enjoyable season I've had, because I felt that because I'd won a world champion and I was current world champion, you know, I had to be, you know, the best every time. And it's just not possible.
Yeah.
It's just not possible. So I took the lesson I learned from that was to that it's not possible that I can proudly wear the stripes any day of the week, and I do, but I don't have to prove anything, you know. So I can step back now, and you know, I'm happy to have a few beers and relax and do those things and step away from it for a while. It doesn't take me long to want to get back, but I, you know, quite often I need that period. That can be a week, it could be a month, but it's generally quite a, you know, it's generally a, you know, reasonably short period. It's within a 2 to 3 week period that I can go, okay, I've had my, you know, my holiday or rest or whatever you want to call it. Now I'll go back into some sort of structure. And that structure doesn't have to be, you know, aiming to, you know, win anything. It's just to be aiming to, you know, get fit. I suppose at the moment I'm in that, you know, that place at the moment. I was quite sick for 3 or 4 weeks. And now I'm just getting back on the bike now. So now I'll just go through a plan of, you know, enjoying it. And then once I'm fit enough, I'll then go into doing, you know, planning something. I'd certainly like to go back to ride the track again in LA this year, but yeah, you know, whether that's ever going to happen or not, it's another story. And I'd certainly go back to ride the Grand Fondo World Championships as well, because that's a little bit of a, you know, unfinished business as well. So,
you know, oh, that's great. LA is on my plan also for this year. So hopefully we'll have a chance to meet face to face in LA. Yeah. The other thing, of course, to keep in mind, which, you know, my kids remind me all the time, is, you know, the last time we went to the World Championships, they saw actually the medal being awarded for the 100 plus category, which the UCI has now introduced. So, you know, my kids just turned to me and said, listen, Dad, you just keep trying. You've got another 50 years to win that medal. So, you know, I think, but also, Bill, I think that is very important, that, you know, we as often driven people, as very motivated people, we tend to have a little bit of a too short time horizon. You know, we want everything and we want it now. And I think that's something which we also have to learn, is that, you know, life is long. And certainly as a master's athlete, you know, if it's not going to be this year, if life gets in the way, if a pandemic gets in the way, or, you know, your work gets in the way, family commitments are there, then it's okay, because most of us have another 20, 30, even 40 years ahead of us as cyclists. So we sometimes need to keep that perspective.
You need, Yeah, for sure. You know, that's, yeah, certainly, you know, I think the pandemic has certainly taught us a bit of patience, to be patient and not, you know, like, yeah, it's just what it is now. So, you know, the idea is that if you do need time away from it, then take it.
Take it
up. It's not the end. In fact, it, you know, it can be good for you.
Excellent. Okay, with that, Bernard Moederman, Bill Gordon, I'd like to thank you both for this fascinating interview. Bill, you mentioned the importance of learning and especially, you know, connecting and learning from people with wisdom. And I would just like to thank you for sharing your incredible wisdom with our audience today. I think you've really offered some very practical, pragmatic and really down to earth advice for people to juggle those three balls, you know, that we've been talking about. So Bill Gordon, you know, entrepreneur, world champion, great dad, parent and grandfather as well. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on This Cycling Life, and we wish you every success for the future. For those of you who've been watching, if you have enjoyed this video, of course, please do give us the thumbs up and slam that subscribe button. So Bill Gordon, again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Perfect. That was great. Bill, thanks a lot. Wow.
Okay, Bernard, no problem at all.
How'd you feel, Bill?
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Now, I don't, as I said, I'm quite comfortable talking about, you know, where I've been and what I've done. So, you know, because I,